Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. As I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 0.0005% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly. They can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
In the first year of peace, more than 2 million couples were married. By 1950, 21 million babies had been born in a seemingly endless baby boom.
I came out of service out of the Navy in 46, and I wanted to go and marry the girl that was writing the 3 letters a week to me for 4 years. And she lived in Floral Park. I had a tavern there. And I moved in with the family. There was a mother and father, her sister and brother, and myself, and a baby coming on after a year.
Despite weeks and months of house hunting, some 3 million married couples throughout the country today are still unable to establish homes of their own.
When you look at the books that you read in school, you read of people in a house. You never read of people living in an apartment, which we did, in trees. It sounds, and it's all new, you know, it was really something that you would like to have.
Guess I don't have to tell you, Mrs. Blandings, what a woman's touch could do to a place like this. Yes, sir. A couple of coats of paint, a little pointing up here and there.
Of course, we wanted our own house, and after, what was it, 2 years? Yeah, two years. In furnished rooms. And if you could see some of the dumps we lived in, it was really... Remember that attic room?
Yes.
In Jamaica? Yuck.
I've got to have a home.
No one is to blame, yet everyone is to blame. There's been a lag in home construction for more than 15 years.
In 1945, Americans needed 5 million new low-cost homes, and they needed them right away.
Now there are building materials.
The elusive dream of home ownership would soon be realized by a man about to fulfill a dream of his own and invent a new phenomenon, suburbia.
Bill Leavitt, as a young man working with the Seabees in World War II, has this brilliant idea, taking some of the techniques he's seeing right then and there in World War II, building airstrips, putting up housing for GIs, and bringing them back to America for ordinary people. He's sitting there at night with his pals in the Pacific in World War II and saying, you know, what do you want when you get home? Well, I want a house and a car.
Bill Leavitt's special genius was figuring out how to mass produce the American dream.
We first came to see that property where they were going to build. It was potato farms, and it stretched like from here to eternity. You would see concrete foundations, nothing but concrete with the heat in. And then down the road there, we were in the midst of all the dust, was a frame job going on. And then down on the dust was where he completed was the sheathing going. And then down the road a bit, and it was like putting your clothes on, from your socks on first, you know, and then putting your underwear on and the shirt, and finally way down on the other end.
It was a finished product.
Was a finished house. And yet, you could see how it grew.
Before the war, the average contractor built 5 houses a year. In Levittown, Long Island, they built 36 houses a day, a grand total of 17,450. Designed for a family of 4, Leavitt's basic Cape Cod sold for a minimum down payment at a price most people could afford.
I think there's a great ad in there. Mr. Veteran, you're a lucky guy. You know, you can buy this house with $100 down. The first day that they were going to sell them, the lines were, I mean, people started lining up 72 hours before the houses went on sale. Even Levitt was stunned.
A second Levittown in Pennsylvania was every bit as successful as the Long Island Levittown. Everyone, it seemed, wanted a Bill Levitt home.
I beg your pardon, sir. Would you mind telling me who you are and where you're from?
I'm Dave Poole from Atlantic City, New Jersey.
And would you tell me why you're moving here to Levittown?
Well, I'm working in this area now, and I've looked the houses over, and I think it's a fine place to raise a family, so I've decided to buy one.
Very good, sir.
My house was a little Cape Cod cottage with a trellis over the door and one window on either side, and it was four rooms, nice kitchen, an eat-in kitchen, decent-sized living room, two small bedrooms, and a bathroom, and it had doors that I could close and open and close and open with. We had always lived in furnished rooms. We had no privacy whatsoever, nothing. It was perfect for a young couple.
And we had a Bendix in the kitchen.
That's right, Bendix washing machine in the kitchen. First time I ever saw a washing machine, I think.
And we fell in love because that washing machine was underneath the stairs, you know. And before that, when we had the baby, you know, it was like 16, 17 diapers a day to wash, boil them on the stove. And needless to say, the family wanted to get rid of us, too. They didn't need a baby that was crying in that, you know, tight quarters. You know, and to have a house of your own. Man, that was the way we felt, you know.
After the Depression, all this come on, so it was kind of a gift from heaven, you know, you found these wonderful houses to move in.
And the best thing about it, I guess, was our independence. It was the first time we were away from our parents, completely independent, and we did what we wanted when we wanted. Like any kids, they wanted to be on their own, and we were.
And we could start our family.
That's right. And the rapport between neighbors was, at first, was very good. Excellent, in fact.
Because they were all in the same boat as us. They were all first starting out, mostly young like us, and just starting with their family and their first house, too.
The new middle-class families of Levittown had one other thing in common. They were all white.
I walked up to the salesperson, and I said to him, "We're very interested in your house, and we'd like an application." And I remember what he said to me. He looked at me, said, "It's not me, but the management has not as yet decided whether he's going to sell these houses to Negroes or not." And
you can't believe it. You really thought you had it made. You know, everything is falling into place.
Well, I'd like you to conceive that somebody telling you that, and there's no recourse, telling you that openly and outright like that.
Bill Levitt saw himself as a home builder, not as a social engineer, and he refused to sell the box. There were court cases against him. And the fact is, he was all too typical of what existed in real estate in America in those days, in believing that you did not have to and should not have to sell to people who were not white.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is William Levitt, who heads the largest home-building firm in the world.
Bill Levitt would become one of the richest men in America by providing architectural, not racial, equality.
Unlike anything we ever encountered before.
This is one of four models which are now being built throughout Levittown. The four models vary slightly in overall design, but each has the same number of rooms. Two bedrooms.
I think it was that sense that Americans really did like the comfort of having what the other guy had, but yet they could put a little fence around it and say, "This is mine." And that's really a particular American genius, is to say, "This is yours, this is mine, but we're still all the same."
Did you get all your trees yet? Is this the first one?
An army of Levitt imitators carried the housing revolution across the country.
Thank goodness that.
By 1955, three out of every four houses built were built in Levitt-style subdivisions.
I think Levittown represented to a lot of city dwellers a dream that had eluded them all through the Depression and the war, which was to have a place somewhere with a patch of green in the back where their kids were going to be able to live better than they did. And to that extent, it fulfilled that particular vision. To another whole group of us growing up in cities, Levittown was a surrender. You know, that was exactly what we didn't want to be. To us, going to Levittown would be like going to Attica.
Its critics said that Levittown was little more than a voluntary prison, a multitude of uniform houses lined up at uniform distances, on uniform roads, in a treeless waste. What the critics said did not matter to the homeowners of Levittown. They had built sturdy new lives in sturdy new houses and wrapped their newborn into the nest. What worried many Americans was not the conformity of their own lives, but communist Russia.
And today's podcast is titled The Benjamin Pap Singleton and Allen Brothers Solution, 619-768-2945. And who was Benjamin Pap Singleton and who were the Allen Brothers? Well, let's start with the Allen Brothers. We mentioned the Allen Brothers yesterday. They're the brothers that co-founded the city of Houston, Texas. They bought a huge tract of land, and, well, we see what it turned out to be today. Those brothers, well, let me give you their exact names. Let me go to the history. Augustus Chapman Allen and John Kirby Allen, once again, both brothers. The brothers, on August 26, 1836, bought from Elizabeth E. Parrott, wife of T.F.L. Parrott, the widow of John Austin, the south half of the Lower League tract, which was over 2,000 acres, actually 2,214 acres. You know, people still buy that today. I mean, not that tract, but that much land. Granted her by a late husband, they paid $5,000 for over 2,000 acres of land. Now, mind you, it was nothing like it looks today. And out of that was the sales price, $5,000, but they only put $1,000 down. Okay. And then they made monthly payments, and then they developed that, and it's we see what it is to now. And then, and that's the solution. They were speculators, but to clarify more, let's put Benjamin Pap Singleton of what I'm trying to convey today. Benjamin Pap, let me open it up. Benjamin Pap Singleton, 1809 to 1892, was an American activist and businessman best known for his role in establishing African-American settlements in Kansas. Now, we have a picture of him in our role in Mercatus One. He's an African-American guy. A former slave from Tennessee who escaped to freedom in 1846, he became a noted abolitionist, community leader, and spokesman for African-American civil rights. And you know what? The word civil rights, the term civil rights, a lot of people, civil rights means your freedom to do stuff. He decided to act on his civil rights of founding townships. He saw that there was a need to start up communities, start up little towns, little villages, where African Americans who were escaped freedom or newly freed slaves or what have you, a place where they can live without fear of being lynched, where they can work, where they can build their own homes, stuff like that. He built what I would call a niche market community. Matter of fact, the movement that they, well, you know what, let me read this a little bit. All right. He escaped to freedom in 1846, became known as an abolitionist, community leader, a spokesman for African-American civil rights. He returned to Tennessee during the Union occupation of 1862, but soon concluded that blacks would never achieve economic equality in a white-dominated South. To the end of Reconstruction, Singleton organized a movement of thousands of black colonists known as Exodus to found settlements in Kansas. A prominent voice of early black nationalism, he became involved in promoting and coordinating black-owned businesses in Kansas and developed interest in a Back to Africa movement. Now, he would have been a citizen. Like, his would have been a third Black to Africa movement. We'll cover that another day. Let's go into the Exodus. Exodus were the name given to African-Americans who migrated from states along the Mississippi River to Kansas in the late 19th century as part of the Exodus movement, or Exodus of 1879. It was the first generation migration of black people following the Civil War. The movement received substantial organizational support from prominent figures like Benjamin Singleton, who we're talking about, of Tennessee, and Henry Adams of Louisiana. As many as 40,000 Exodus left the South to settle in Kansas, Oklahoma, and Colorado. Okay. And we did a podcast earlier this year about one of them in Colorado. He read Up from Slavery and started the town of Deerfield, Colorado, which is now a ghost town, but at one time it was prospering. Anyway, let's see. Promised lands. All right, well, hold on. Well, let's go in order. Reality of life for blacks in post-Reconstruction South. The number one cause of black migration out of the South at this time was to escape racial violence or bulldozing by white supremacist groups such as the KKK and the White League, as well as widespread repression under the Black Codes, discriminatory laws that render blacks second-class citizens after Reconstruction. Vigilantes operated with almost total impunity, and no other issue was of more importance to the majority of Southern blacks living in the countryside. Given the extreme level of discrimination and violent intimidation blacks faced in rural South, the Exodus can more accurately be described as refugees. Although blacks greatly outnumbered whites in Louisiana, black armed resistance was practically inconceivable. According to William Murrow, a testimonial given in the United States Senate, the white people in Louisiana are better armed and better equipped than during the war. As evidence of the frightening lawlessness which empowered the terrorist activities of the White League in the mid-1870s, the League managed to seize a huge cache of arms and arsenals in New Orleans worth, back then, $67,000. Stolen directly from the United States government. The Exodus were not only fleeing extremist groups like the KKK. In fact, throughout Reconstruction, the majority of Southern white population continued to resent black emancipation, resulting in the oppression environment perpetuated by all segments of white society. Most black migration, included the Exodus of 1879, was spurred by the dire economic prospects for black labor in the rural South. The Depression of the 1870s served to exacerbate the racist policies of white merchants and planters who sought to offset their agricultural losses by increasing prices and the interest rates for blacks. Most Southern states completely undermined federal Reconstruction efforts to promote land owning as blacks' tickets for economic freedom and equality. For example, in 1865, the Mississippi Black Code outlawed the selling and or leasing of land to blacks. As a result, in large parts of Mississippi, less than 1 out of 100 black workers owned land or a house. In the aftermath of the Compromise of 1877, the traumatic political campaigns of 1878 in Louisiana and the plight of organized black resistance had reached a point of hopelessness, leading to the exodus of 1879. Political and economic oppression enforced the means, both legal and illegal, on the streets and the contracts at both the local and federal levels. Grassroots black political activism exemplified. All right, long story short, Benjamin Pap Singleton saw a need. He saw a need to create communities where black people can move to and have some type of peace of mind and physical peace. The promised lands, now this is part of the Exodus movement, Kansas versus Liberia. Before the Exodus of 1879 to Kansas, Southern blacks convened to discuss the option of immigration, both formally and informally. Now, this is way before Marcus Garvey. Okay. Delegates from Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Texas, Arkansas, and Georgia met at a New Orleans conference in 1875 and discussed black immigration to Western territories and Liberia. Black settlement outside the South as a result of immigration was termed colonization. And the New Orleans Committee meeting became a full-fledged organization dubbed the Colonization Council. The council held its first public meetings in 1877. Council meetings consisted of speech-making and the petition writing and signing of some 98,000 men, women, and children from Louisiana signed onto the immigration list. Liberia proved an unreal Liberian, what we call Liberia now in Africa, proved to be an unrealistic destination for black refugees financially and logistically. As the land of John Brown, Kansas had fought bitterly for its free state status and took its fair treatment of black immigrants as a point of pride. Kansas did not actively encourage the Exodus. Rather, its equal opportunity stance was more welcoming in comparison to the most of the country that was recognized as the United States. Reality in Kansas. The most successful of the Exodus were those who moved to the urban centers and found work as domestic and trade workers. Almost all Exodus who attempted to homestead in the countryside settled in the Kansas uplands, which presented the most formidable obstacles to small-scale farmers. The uplands were the only lands available to purchase after the squatters, railroads, speculators had taken the best farmland. Given the agricultural challenge of farming these lands, many Exodus were destitute a year after their arrival, a response to the Exodus. Okay. The Exodus, and we may as well call this the Black Exodus of 1879, consisted mostly of refugees fleeing Mississippi and Louisiana between March and May, and Texas later in the year. The most considerable uncertainty at that time as to the actual number of Exodus that arrived in St. Louis. However, the Colored Relief Board estimated that 20,000 black Exodus reached the city between 1879 and 1880. The St. Louis Globe Democrat quoted 6,206 arriving between March and April 1879 alone. Many steamboat captains refused to carry black migrants across the Mississippi River, and thousands of Exodus found themselves stranded for months in St. Louis, Missouri. Black churches in St. Louis, together with the Eastern Philanthropists, formed the Colored Relief Board and the Kansas Freedmen's Aid Society, to help those stranded in St. Louis, Missouri, reach Kansas. In contrast to fundraising success in Kansas, St. Louis officials discouraged the exodus whenever possible, and therefore the burden of providing stranded exodus fell entirely on the St. Louis black community. Other private relief organizations were funded by Quakers and other abolitionists in the northern states and England. Now, mind you, people, blacks at this time in the United States, at least in this geographical area, because there were no government entitlement programs, they had to get it from the rough. They had to get together and do so. The Kansas Freedmen's Aid Society raised more than $70,000 in support for black exodus migration and a settlement of $13,000, of which came from England. The failure of the federal and state governments to financially support black migrants came attributed to both bureaucratic incompetence, as in the case of the mayor of Kansas being denied temporary assistance from the Secretary of War due to congressional jurisdiction. Okay, let me skip down. Exodus, impact on Exodus. Although the Exodus, the Black Exodus of 1879 saw a high volume of black migration during the shorter periods of time, most of the black migration to Kansas occurred steadily throughout the decade. The black population of Kansas increased by some 26,000 people during the 1870s. Historian Nell Painter further asserts that the sustained migration of some 9,500 blacks from Tennessee to Kentucky to Kansas during the decade far exceeded the much publicized migration of 1879, which netted no more than 4,000 people from Louisiana. During the 1870s decade that followed, blacks bought more than 20,000 acres of land in Kansas and several other settlements established during that time. Nicodemus, Kansas, which was one of those settlements, was founded in 1877, and it still exists today. Of note, however, Western migration of African Americans was not limited to the Exodus period in places like Quindaro, Kansas. I never heard of that place. Well, let me read about it real quick. The Quindaro town site, the settlement was established by abolitionists, black abolitionists, in 1856, with the construction starting in 1857. The town was rapidly settled by migrants aided by the New England Immigrant Aid Company, who were trying to help secure Kansas as a free territory. One of the number of villages hugging the narrow bank of the Missouri River, under the bluffs of the town was a free state port of entry for abolitionist forces in Kansas. It was established as a part of the resistance to stop the westward spread of slavery. Quindaro's people also aided the escaped slaves from Missouri and linked them to the Underground Railroad. After Kansas was established as a free state, there was less unique need for a port and the growth of slow commercial district. At the same time, the economy of Kansas suffered from over-speculation. Okay, that's a little bit about. Well, anyway, I'm reading all this to say this. The Allen brothers, who were two guys who bought over 2,000 acres of land in Texas. They were speculators, land speculators. And then they started a commercial venture. Other people buy tracts of land called company towns because politically and legally, they can make a product that they can sell to other people outside of those towns. Pap Singleton, and others, they created or founded, you can call them villages, small towns, whatever you want to call them. They started niche market communities, essentially not so much as a commercial venture, but their niche market was a safe place for former slaves or black folks back in that era, where they can have peace of mind psychologically and physical safety from getting lynched or whatever else diabolical that can happen. And that's why, going back to Black Wall Street, when a lot of people talk about Black Wall Street, and most of the people that even comment on don't even know that in Oklahoma at the exact same time, there were 50 municipalities, 50 black municipalities. That doesn't include black communities that were not municipalities. There were over 50 black communities in Oklahoma at the exact same time. To this day, never experienced any type of racial violence because of where they geographically, where they well, to be honest about it, they didn't build their communities in a hostile territory. Black Wall Street was, which is really the Greenwood neighborhood at that time, was literally built in hostile territory. So is it any surprise if you build anything in a hostile territory that something, I mean, that increases the probability of something might happen? Doesn't guarantee it, but it just increases the probability that something negative could happen. The other black folk in Oklahoma and other places around the country, and really on the continent, because black folks built townships from Canada all the way down to Argentina. Most of those villages that they built didn't experience any harm because they just didn't build in a hostile territory. The Greenwood neighborhood, better known as Black Wall Street, you can sort of say was a failed attempt at that time, a failed attempt of immigration. Blacks, you know, O.W. Gurley bought 40 acres of land, and he only sold the black. Nothing wrong with that. But it was a hostile platform territory. Didn't work out. Whereas other towns that, you know, Boley, Oklahoma, Taft, Oklahoma, these towns still exist. No, Redbird, Oklahoma. They're tiny towns, micro towns, but they still exist. They still exist. And if you take a page out of the Allen Brothers, who, you know, formed Houston, Texas, and then or founded Houston, Texas, and then Pat Singleton, who set up several colonies for blacks, you can essentially go. You don't have to go to Oklahoma, you don't have to go to Kansas or Colorado, but there's scores of places all across the United States where you can go, and I mean, sometimes you can buy. There are towns that are up for sale right now. Occasionally you see them on eBay for sale. There's some towns that are ghost towns that if you go in there and do your research, you can buy the tax certificates and tax deeds and then buy the town on the cheap that way and just redevelop it. Now, it'll be easy to do that because the land is easy to get. That's the easy part. To get your ducks lined up, to get your financing all together, you need to organize. You need to identify a community. And all different type of communities that need some type of they have some type of unfulfilled needs. Then ex-offenders out here called returning citizens now, a lot of them that might find it hard to find affordable housing in your larger cities, that's a niche market. You can build a community on that. You have a lot of aging baby boomers that they need affordable places to stay. People who put their parents or grandparents in a nursing home and their baby boomers or whoever going into nursing homes that are getting evicted from nursing homes because they can't afford to pay $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 a month. You can start a community. There a whole lot of people out here that are living in cars, vans, trucks, living in shelters. There's a whole lot of communities out here. Identify one or two, and you know what? Just buy an acre of land. Start off small. An acre is a football field. And build, you know, a little house on there and then start serving that particular niche market. Learn from that and just keep on, just do it again and again and again and again and again. That's the Benjamin Papp Singleton, or what I call the Benjamin Papp Singleton Allen Brothers solution. Identify a community or communities that have a need. Go out and find you a patch of land. I do not recommend going out like the Allen Brothers and buying 2,000 acres of land. Nor do I recommend, Pap Singleton, he had a, you know, he set up several colonies, so to speak. So let's just update instead of using the word colonies, but just identify communities that have a need for affordable housing, and go from there. Matter of fact, now before we go to the phone lines here, let's see. There's another audio that I want. I've played it on here several times before. This is titled Balling on Baltic, based on the Monopoly game. The Monopoly game is like there's a lot of real economic lessons you can learn in that game. We're going to listen to Balling on Baltic because that identifies communities as well. So if you're living in a community or can identify a community or communities within a community, then you can do just like the Allen Brothers and Pap Singleton and a gazillion other people. Identify a community and then go out here and you can set up a Facebook page virtually. And then take those people and then put them in a physical community.
Before I get started with this video, I just want to personally thank the brother Fred Hassan Powell of the Morale Facebook page for sharing this social political cartoon, which is currently displayed in this video. I always big up brothers who are artists like him, my man Will James, Alex K. Art, Chris Miller, and others, because their pictures speak volumes. They don't have to say one word because, as they say, a picture is worth a thousand words. In fact, I want y'all to take a good look at this picture, which shows a brother with his hat flipped to the back telling the bald-headed brother that he's hungry as fuck. When the brother attempts to hand him his own fishing rod so he can get some fish on his own, he gets verbally assaulted. No, nigga, I want some fish. Fuck out of here with that coon shit. I mean, if you look closer, you see that the brother that says he's hungry got a fresh pair of Jordans on his feet. And once again, I want to thank you, Fred, for sharing that photo because it is a perfect warm-up for what I'm getting ready to bring up next. Look, last week, I had to stop past a gas station, and when I went in, I took a quick glance over to the newsstand, and I saw the Washington Post. The first thing that caught my eye was something that you normally don't see on the cover of a newspaper, which was a few straggling pants sagging brothers sitting on a stoop of a building outside. I didn't have the time to read the paper in the gas station because I had to fly, but I checked the article online when I got home, and I was just flabbergasted. I want you all to check it out for yourself in the description box. It is the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, and the front cover story is a look back at the riots which took place in Baltimore this past April following the death of Freddie Gray. The Post took the time to interview a few of the residents and get their personal take on how things have been and has any positive change come to the streets of Baltimore after the riots. And one of the brothers that they interviewed was a young man that was out there on the streets peddling drugs from time to time, and he stated that he ended up finding out shortly after the riots that there were a few storefront apartments that were up for sale and that they were only selling for just $5,000 apiece. He then said that when he ran the idea of getting together and investing in the neighborhood past several brothers that he was out there selling drugs with on the streets, all of them told him no. And see, this goes to what brothers like myself, Sean James, and many others who are right here on YouTube have been telling y'all about this modern Negro. Okay, this Baltimore brother that was interviewed by the Washington Post had a great idea and the right frame of mind to purchase this storefront property while the price is extremely low. But the rest of the Negroes that are around him ended up dragging him into the quagmire of apathy that surrounds the Negro landscape.
She a deuce. She get hit you in your face. She a deuce. That bitch scared, nigga. Oh, oh. Beat her motherfucking ass. She drug you, motherfucking nigga. Beat her motherfucking ass.
That nigga can't be a homeless cell.
You from New State.
Look, the main spot that this brother was looking to purchase had five rooms between both of the upstairs levels, and it just needed a little bit of furnishing. These spots could have easily been rented out to tenants or used as cheap housing by family and friends that could have worked a legitimate business out of that storefront. The Negro just don't get it, because the more legitimate storefronts, strip mall shops, apartments, and tenements you own would lessen the police targeting you, because then you can do what the foreigners and white folks that own these places do, which is hire the police to work security at your properties and places of business. Why do you think they don't go upside the heads of these foreigners? Because they step to the police officers and let them know that they have work for them. These foreigners and white folks that own and run these storefronts hire the cops, and if they don't pay them with cash, they give them free merchandise and meals on the house, so they in turn look out for them. And half these cops do moonlighting security at these places even when they are on duty, because all they got to do most of the time is just drive through with a squad car or do a quick foot patrol right near the business or apartment housing units that are being rented out. This is why they don't give the Chan family or any Chinese youngster any problems when they see them in the hood by their dry cleaners. This is why they don't bother Mr. or Mrs. Akbar or any Arab kids that they see near the gas stations they own. This is why they don't mess with Miss Yee or any of her grandkids that are close to the nail salon she owns, because they take a small percentage of the proceeds and pad the local policeman's pockets. And see, your typical foolish Negro that would challenge what I just told you will say, well, see, you insinuating that we got to bribe the police for them to stop brutalizing us. But they, like most, don't know anything about capitalism. It is a game of economic musical chairs. I just gave you the analogy when I mentioned all the foreign families that own all the storefronts, strip malls, and rental properties. Who is the only one who is left standing up with no businesses or property to speak of when the music is done playing and the cops roll through the neighborhood? That's us, yapping back and forth when the music stops and they tell our loitering asses to get moving or catch a bruising. That's us, walking around with sagging pants and glow-in-the-dark fluorescent color wigs like this sister that you see right here tossing rocks during the riot last April. Now, she's throwing rocks and expressing her anger and frustration, but she has a fresh weave on top of her head, which helped pay some of the officers that broke Freddie Gray's back. So who is the sellout and coon, black folks? And think about it. If you own some of those storefronts and control the flow of unlaundered, legitimate-made currency that comes through those areas, you can do your illegal dirt all day long without that much harassment from the local authorities. You might draw attention from a few alphabet gang organizations like the DEA, FBI, and others, but the local guys aren't going to pay that much attention because you're helping them pay bills and you're putting food in their stomach. And since I brought up the subject of illegal activity, and you pants-sagging clowns love to talk about how gangster you are, why don't you do what some of the Irish, Italian, Jewish, and Polish immigrants your dumbass keeps trying to emulate did by legitimizing some of your hustles and using the same police force that chases you around the neighborhood as a shield? See, most Negroes will try to tell you that we are always at the end of a nightstick, a baton, or getting showered with bullets just because we are black. But ask yourself a question. Why aren't that many Ethiopians and West Africans getting mollywopped and punished to the extent that many so-called African Americans are in the U.S.? Remember, they're just as black and sometimes way darker than us. But why are there fewer cases of them being brutalized and killed by the police, like we saw with Amadou Diallo or Abner Louima, both of which took place in New York? Why so few cases compared to us so-called Afro-Americans? It's because they're smart enough to own businesses, restaurants, furniture stores, parking lots, etc., and pay the cops to look the other way so their fellow countrymen aren't harmed in any way. That's the logical thing to do. But you can't tell this Negro from America that, because you're still living off the backwards principle and creed of entitlement, which these liberals drafted up for us long ago. Instead of assessing this situation from a global perspective and seeing that everyone else seems to be purchasing everything around us so they can live comfortable lives and keep us at a position of marginalization as opposed to putting themselves in that boat, the Negro man and woman in the U.S. will counter it by saying, see, I object because my tax dollars pay for the police not to harass me. No, they don't, you imbecile. Especially after Uncle Sam rapes their paycheck just like he rapes everybody else's. Now, your pro-rack movement pseudo-black nationalist leaders will call me a coon for telling you this, but this is something that they know firsthand. They also know that you more than likely won't view this phenomenon from all angles because you're still under the influence of the can't we all just get along flavor Kool-Aid most black folks drank after the post-civil rights movement era, thinking that all the bigotry-enhanced physical assaults and beatdowns we took during chattel slavery and Jim Crow had an exclusive cutoff date to them. Which is why every single year one of these highly publicized police brutality incidents takes place, there's some dumb Negro that says, I don't believe that in 2087 this is still happening to black people. Yeah, it is. And it's going to keep on happening in 2088 if you don't adopt a different way of thinking, dummy. Your pseudo-black nationalists won't tell you that you are mostly to blame for this continually happening because they want you to keep feeling sorry for yourself and attend more lectures and debates where they argue over whether or not a woman is God or which master teacher's philosophy is better to follow. But I'm here to tell you right now, black folks, that we don't need to attend a gazillion seminars, travel with a million other jugheads to commemorate the anniversary of a march that never led to mass black improvement, or study the teachings of some philosophical doctor with 10 degrees to find a solution to our problem. This brilliant brother from Baltimore that was interviewed in the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, who more than likely didn't even finish high school, just gave us the answer. And if you're wondering why I titled this thing Ballin' on Baltic Avenue, I did so as a way of saluting one of my grandfathers. See, long ago when I was a very little boy, he taught me how to play Monopoly. I was about 7 years old, and I was all geeked up racing around the board to buy Boardwalk and Park Place. And he said, go right on ahead. He let me do it, and said, I'll just buy a Baltic, Mediterranean, Oriental, and all these other properties that you aren't even thinking about. So as the game went on, and I only owned Boardwalk, Park Place, and Pacific, I think, he had all the other properties, the railroads, the waterworks, the electric company, and a whole bunch of hotels and houses on all of them while I was looking silly. And I ended up having to sell what I owned and wait for that $200 paycheck once I passed go. Once it finally set in that I lost the game, he chuckled and told me, son, you gotta own what's in the ghetto before you walk around the block. And that lesson that my grandfather Dave, rest his soul, taught me still applies to this very day. Ownership is a universal language, no matter what culture or ethnicity you come from, because it regulates the sort of relationship you're going to have with most of the people around you.
There's a concept and a practice called intentional communities. Once again, like I say, if you can identify, there's a gazillion different types of communities. So you can identify a community, and if you want to stay in an urban environment, maybe you can buy a house, and you can be maybe 3, 4, 5 of you, and your intentional community stays in a house. In a city. Other people can identify a community, and let's say you're still in a city, and let's say you identify a rundown block or a vacant block. It's got boarded up houses. This the whole block is, let's say that the whole block is condemned. You can identify a community, organize your finances by the block, and then, you know, your community moves in. Like, so you need to have your community first in that case, because you're going to need the money to get in it. Then, for people that want a little bit more freedom, or maybe a lot more freedom, can you start your own town? Well, you can. Let me read some things here off the line. Like, it's still possible to buy a town in the United States. Matter of fact, you know what, let's see, towns for sale. Let's go, because occasionally eBay has a town for sale. Towns for sale, eBay. Let's see. Oops, oh, towns for sale, okay. Or you can... I'm going to tell you an easier way. I mean, let me go through this. Let's see. 11 towns for sale. That's an article by Bob Vila. 26 entire villages and towns that you can actually buy. Let's see. 5 ghost towns that you can buy right now. 3 abandoned towns for sale for under $1 million. Let's go there. Let's see, Cabin Creek, Colorado. People who are browsing items for sale on Denver's Craigslist site are likely to notice a listing of a headline, Ghost Town for Sale Indeed. The ghost town, for just $350,000, you can own the entire town of Cabin Creek, Colorado, which is a 1-hour drive east of Denver. It's just under 5 acres, and it's certainly not a booming metropolis, but the property features its own service station, cafe, small motel, all of which are various states of disrepair, 2 small houses, 1 mobile home, a shooting range, an 8 site, RV park, that will pay for the town itself. Get that RV park up and going, that'll provide you the cash flow to pay, get your money back. Old gas station would still have pumps outside. At one time, a small movie theater. Let's see. So, Sweat, Oklahoma, SWE at TT, Nebraska. You can sell for $250,000. Alice Creek, Australia. That's in Australia. That's a 48. Just in the United States, there are tons of places. Matter of fact, now, a lot of places, they got zoning restrictions. You know, like I ran across 10 acres of land, but I can only put 2 houses per 5 acres. Now, I can put other buildings on there as long as I don't call them houses. Okay. Now, there are other places like out in Oklahoma, where the patch of land that we call Earth Wealth Energy Village, it's about like 1.8 acres. And the good thing about it is if it's if you look at it, it looks like it is one piece of land, but it's legally made up of 17 residential building lots. So if I wanted to, I can put up 17 different houses on there legally. I'm not going to do that. We're going to put probably no more than 5 mobile buildings. I didn't say mobile homes, but mobile buildings on that. That's it. Now, there are other places all across the country where, I mean, you drive and, you know, all you see are woods and brush and overgrowth. Some of these could be in urban cities. Some of these could be in rural areas. And I learned this when I went out to Oklahoma. Matter of fact, when I was visiting with 2 mayors out there. And this is fundamental anywhere you go. They said, you know, this used to be, we were driving down the street, and on the visual, all you saw was a wooded area. But then they tell you that it was homes there at one time, and they can name the people and the families that live there. And in some places, if you stop and look, you'll see the street signs there, but it's been all overgrown with brush because nature takes over. And then in some places you might see one dilapidated fallen house, but that's just one house that used to be a whole little subdivision with a block of houses. And then you can see how the city was laid out. And all across the United States, they are acres upon acres of land that are already platted out where, like I say, identify your community, roll up your sleeves, because that's what it's coming to, the way I see it. Particularly for, I mean, as you get older, let's say you get sick. Getting sick in the United States is expensive. You know, you need affordable places to stay. But then, I mean, the mayor's got all, he got all, they're all kind of communities. So I think there's a magazine that talks about intentional communities. We're going to bring on different people that have founded their own intentional communities, bring them on here, let you guys talk to them one-on-one. But, because I'm looking at baby boomers, Generation X's, that group is going to need all kinds of special type communities if they want to have, in my opinion, affordable living conditions. Okay, but let's see. Like seven minutes of sales. But the best stuff that's not off radar. Goes to a and you know, get in good with nail from community. And they years ago, you know, particular street was got how many places and it, what you might renovation on go for new measure. I mean, you, but in any event, food for thought. Phone lines here for you. The mic is open.
L.A., you breaking up. Am I breaking up, too?
Now you're clear.
All right, you better now. No, but that was interesting about the repatriation information you were talking about of blacks wanting to go back to
Exodus.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But you know, many of them, some did go back as early as the late 18th century.
True.
And many of them died because, huh?
They couldn't make it back. Some people went to Liberia, and they, well, I think you mentioned this before. Some couldn't have just. Didn't have the living skills to start little, although they had physical freedom, their liberty, but they didn't have to build houses, that type.
Yeah, they had physical freedom, but they also didn't have the immunity of the surrounding conditions in the
right
where they were at. You know, they had long since lost that. From being away from, well, you know, generation after generation, also intermingling the blood and so on, so on, so on. But that's
right.
Just the way it is. They probably would have survived if they had went to England longer, depending on who they were, because Paul Kofi was a mulatto. He wasn't. He was mixed.
Right.
And,
Yeah. Some probably did go,
just the way.
But you're right. A lot of them, because these weren't the back to Africa, so to speak, originally were not. So you're right. They didn't have the physical immunity. Rarely hear about on you know these blogs or vlogs where you know so, well, let's go back to Africa. Even with the late Charles, well, he Thanksgiving weekend last week. I mean, not here. He was 44th African American. You know, his beast city. That I, you know what? I want to attribute it to heart attack and strokes. I would like him.
Yeah, you breaking up. I'm hearing about every other word you say.
Okay.
I don't know if it's on my line or yours. It's raining
it's
here.
Probably not.
But anyway, man.
Being straight before you make those trips.
Yeah. But anyway, it was a good program this morning. A lot of information shared. And
okay.
I guess you can have a nice weekend.
All right. All right, same year. On that note, everyone have a good rest of the day.